This episode of The Imposter is brought to you by HelloFresh, the meal kit service that's dedicated to making cooking fun, easy, and convenient. I tried their veggie box last week, and it felt really good to eat fresh, healthy meals all week, even when I got home right around dinner time. You can check out their offerings and get 50% off your first box at hellofresh.ca/theimposter. You might have noticed that The Imposter doesn't come out as often as it did last season. And that's because this season, I'm mostly working on the show by myself. And in some ways, it's great. I'm learning more production skills, things like editing, songwriting, sound design, and I still get some assistance when I need it. But the thing is, I've got this huge list of ideas for documentaries, narrative episodes, and long-form interviews that'll dig right into some of the most odd and fascinating untold art and culture stories that this frozen mass has to offer. And even though I could do a lot of it on my own, I think it'll be infinitely better if I work with another producer. The Imposter really hit its stride toward the end of last season, and I'm proud of the places that it went. Ben Cannon of the AV Club called us one of the finest, most compulsively listenable shows in the world of podcasting today. And it wouldn't have gone to those places without Kevin Sexton, who is producing the show with me full-time. Actually, more than full-time in a lot of cases. Our two-part season finale, I Pity the Country, wove together six interviews, all kinds of music, and original reporting. That took the two of us, plus a freelancer, months. And even those 30 or 40 minute interviews that don't sound like they take a lot of production, we often edit them down from conversations that are twice or three times as long, which takes some work. If you listen to the credits of some of your favorite podcasts, you'll hear anywhere from 3 to 10 names. We made 45 weekly episodes with two, and on rare occasion, three. And to be honest, some of those episodes could have used extra hands and ears. And that could have even saved us from doing final edits at 3:30 a.m. This season, I want to keep that momentum going. So if The Imposter is a show that makes you laugh, or if you heard a new song that you loved, or if someone you heard on the show made you think differently, consider backing us. You can do that at patreon.com/CanadaLand. And for the people who have already decided to support this show on Patreon, thank you. It means a lot. From Canada Land, this is The Imposter, and I'm Malia Babani. I've been trying to interview Alanis Obomsawin since The Imposter began. I'm not really prone to hero worship, but if I was, she's probably as close as it gets. And it's because there's just no one else like her. Alanis Obomsawin is an Abenaki filmmaker who just finished her 50th film at the National Film Board. Her first film was an animated short called Christmas at Moose Factory, and it came out in 1971. It's a series of stories from the James Bay community told entirely through the voices of children and their crayon drawings. In the decades since, she's made films about the Oka crisis, about the attacks on Mi'kmaq fishing rights, about Cindy Blackstock's case against the feds for their neglect of Indigenous kids. But I want you to think about that for a second. This is an Indigenous woman who was challenging Canada's narrative about itself almost 50 years ago. Long before Truth and Reconciliation, and she was being funded by the National Film Board to do it. Before I met Alanis, I emailed her publicist to ask if there were any accessibility-related things that I should consider because, you know, she's 85. She emailed me back to say that Alanis still wears heels everywhere she goes and that she'd probably want a glass of water. I met Alanis on a Sunday morning and I was feeling kind of exhausted, but then she started talking. And I felt like not only am I speaking to a person whose work I really deeply respect, I'm speaking to a person whose words contain an incredible amount of force, even though they're being delivered with a kind of softness. I felt like I needed to listen.
I was raised on in a community in a reservation in the province of Quebec. It's called Odanak. And at that time, we didn't have electricity or running water. We had a well. And so in the evening, you sat around the oil lamps and the adults would talk to us, talking about, like, most of the men there were guides in the bush for hunting and fishing. So they always had lots of story about their relation with the people that they guided and the animals. And we used to just love it. But there were no images. So if you had four or five children watching, you had four or five story right there, because the images, you make them up yourself. They're in your imagination. And this is where I think I got this feeling that listening is very important until you can really feel that you think you know that story well, and not to make a mistake. And I think it comes from there. So all the films I make, at first, I just go to the community, to people, with just a tape recorder alone. And in some cases, I've done very long interviews or felt I had to go back because I didn't feel that I had the whole heart of the story. And also, it's intimidating if you first come into the place with a crew and, you know, other people. And in my case, I work a lot in very isolated places. So I want them to feel very comfortable, so that by the time I come back with a crew, they know me, and they know I'm not going to play tricks on them.
It's interesting to hear you talk about sound, because our season finale was a piece on folk country and rock musicians from Indigenous communities from the 60s to the 80s. Mm-hmm. And we covered the Native North America compilation.
Yes.
And until that happened, I actually didn't know that you were a folk singer. I remember looking through all the recordings that the CBC had done around that time, and then seeing your name, and then that's how I realized that you were a musician before you were a filmmaker. And I'm wondering if you could tell me a bit about those times.
Yes. It started at a very young age, because I had a very bad experience with education as a child, and I got beat up a lot by other children. And I also realized that every time there would be the class on the history of Canada, that's where it all come from, the problem, where the teacher would start reading and say that the savages, that's who we were, and that our language was Satan's language, and all kinds of really hateful things towards us. And they succeeded. You know, like the education for Canadians was very poor in terms of the true story. And I realized by the time I was 15, 16, I knew there was something really wrong in the system. And I was thinking, what could I do, little me, you know? So I thought, the children have to hear another story. And that's how I figure, I know my history, I can sing, I'm going to go sing for the children. I'm going to tell them a whole other story than the ones that they're learning officially. And in no time at all, I got into the classroom. And at first, when the teachers would see me coming with my drum, they'd look at me very severely. I guess they would worry, what is she going to tell the children? But I never put them down. I never said, you're lying and what you're doing is wrong. I never said anything like that, although I knew they were.
Huskinung sisak mandalik matina una mandalik matina una puskaniga niguk huskinung sisak Manzalik Matina.
And this is in the early 60s, even late 50s. So I also did a lot of residential school at that time. It never felt a heavy thing for me to do. I really enjoyed every minute of it. And in 1960, I started to do a campaign to build a swimming pool in my community. And CBC did a film on what I was doing.
Alanis Abamsawin. Let me say it again, because no one ever gets it the first time. Alanis Abamsawin.
We began to work. Then there was a white man I had to deal with. They didn't believe in the idea, and they were saying things like this to me. You know, a swimming pool for Indians, why, that's luxury, you know. This is the type of mind they had.
It was from there that I was invited to come to the film board to meet the directors and producers who were on staff at that time. They sat me in a small theater and they said, tell us stories like you do for the classroom. And that's what I started doing. And it was so exciting for me. Mm. I knew nothing about filmmaking. For me, it was total magic. Especially, I thought, when people have passed on and you can still see them alive. I was often thinking about that, how incredible that would be. And the film board was really the best school in the world at that time. You know. They would put a student next to this small projector. And you put your strip of 35 mil in it. And over here you had a tape recorder for the sound. And in my case, the sound was on a long playing record.
Mm-hmm.
And but at first, before I finished my project, they would put a student next to this small projector, and you'd hear the sound, and maybe the sound said, there were 12 cheese here. And the child would change the frame by hand. So she would wait for, or he would wait for the sound and change frame by hand. By the time I was finished my project, it was a little bit more modern. Mm-hmm. And on the record, it would say, there were 12 chiefs here, boing! And the frame would change.
So that was the advance.
Yeah, that was the advance. And I thought, by the time I was finished, I thought, oh my God, when I go back to the community to show this, they'll think I'm retarded. You know, why this boing after each phrase? I was very nervous about that.
And how did they react?
Well, you know, it was funny, really, really funny. But they were so happy that to have their voices in the classroom directly to tell their own time, their own story, which was a very different story than us being called savages and all that stuff, you know.
How did you manage to infiltrate that space? Like you were saying, that not only did you get into regular classrooms, but also residential schools. Like, how did you manage to convince them to let you do that?
Well, I didn't have to do much of that because I used to sing a lot at parties and places like that. And I was asked to sing and to tell stories in different places. And in the 60s, I also, at that time, I was told that in prison, the population of the penitentiary, 68% were indigenous people. So I said, yeah, well, then it means my relations are in jail. I'm going to go visit them. So I did a lot of touring in prison.
Huh.
I've been in places, penitentiary, that I was the first person to go in there to do I don't know what to call it. Perhaps they call it entertainment. And I was so scared to look sexy that I had this nun's apron. And the apron, it's not like the apron we wear. The apron is like a whole dress you put over their uniform. Mm-hmm. And it's got puffy sleeves. The cut was quite nice, you know. And I remember one particular prison that I went to. So I arrived in this place, and there was, I don't know if he was a guard, a man who was there, and I forget the time, but let's say they said I could be there from 2 to 4. And I arrived a bit earlier, and this man said, you know, Madame Alanis, he's calling me Madame Alanis. He said, I don't know if any prisoners are going to come and see you, because this is the first time, and they're telling each other, oh, why should they come and sit and listen to me or to whoever would be coming in to perform. And I remember I had this nun dress on. And then when, you know, let's say it's 2:30, there's nobody there. And the man said, I'm so sorry, I don't think they're going to come. I said, well, that's okay. I'm allowed to stand till 4. I'll stand till 4, so nobody, it's okay, I'll just leave. So, you know, maybe a quarter to 3, there's nobody. And then all of a sudden, they start coming in. And it was a cement floor, and the noise of the chairs moving, and there was 500 prisoners that came in.
Oh, my God.
And so I called them the guard. I don't know if they were. I guess they must have been. And he had a microphone on a pole, and the floor was even, so you can't see anybody. You just see heads. It's badly, you know.
Oh, like no one can see you. No. Who's in the back.
Yeah. So I look at the situation, and I took the chair that I was supposed to be sitting on, and I put it on the table. And then I got another chair. I got up, and I got up on the table, and I sat on that chair. Then I could see everybody. And I started to sing, and there was two prisoners at the front row. They were laughing at me, but they were laughing. It reminded me when I went to church as a child. I used to laugh when the priest would start talking, and my mother would say, stop laughing. Like, you just can't stop laughing. You know, that laugh that comes from far. Well, these two prisoners, their shoulders were moving from their laughing. Just imagine they're seeing me in my nun's apron, my drum, and I'm sitting on top of a chair. So I was getting nervous, you know. I said, if you think it's easy for me to come here, sing for you guys. I said, these two in the front are killing themselves laughing at me. I said, I'm going to sing again. And if they continue, I'll get them to sit at this table, and I'll sit as prisoner. We'll see how it feels. And finally, when let's say 4 o'clock, the guard comes in the front. He said, okay, now you guys, you got to go back to your cell, and she has to leave right now. And you know, not one of them left without shaking my hand or kissing me on the cheek, and including these two guys. And they said, oh, I'm so sorry. I said, don't worry. I understood. I've done the same thing in church. You know, I know what it feels when you can't stop laughing. And I said, I know what I look like. Must have been very funny.
This episode of The Imposter is sponsored by HelloFresh. HelloFresh is a meal kit service made for people who buy aspirational groceries. You know, you go to the grocery store, you get all this beautiful, fresh produce, and you imagine yourself getting home at a reasonable hour every day so that you can cook for yourself. In reality, though, you end up cutting chunks of hideous rot off that produce until you finally give up and throw it in the compost. And then you order takeout because you're tired and planning meals is actually way more complicated than it seems like it is. HelloFresh makes it so that you can eat those healthy meals all week without the grocery store, without the cooking time, and without the food waste. I got their veggie plan last week and I made a squash and pesto flatbread, a potato and cauliflower curry, and an Italian lentil stew with cheesy eggplant. It was really nice to have three delicious, very different tasting dinners in a row without having a ton of dishes to wash after. And it took less than 45 minutes. And I even had leftovers. And that means I actually saved money. HelloFresh has a few different meal plans to choose from, and if you want to try it out, you can get 50% off your first box by going to HelloFresh.ca/TheImpostor and enter the promo code IMPOSTOR when you subscribe. Again, that's HelloFresh.ca/TheImpostor. Try it out. Alanis, I wanted to talk about your film, Kanesatake, 270 Years of Resistance, which is probably one of your best-known films and is about the Oka Crisis, which was a standoff between the government and the Mohawk people around a golf course that was supposed to be built on Mohawk land. Yeah. You were right in the siege. How did that happen?
Actually, I was working on another film, and I was in my car going to the film board. And on the radio, they're saying, there's been a shootout in Kahnawake, Oka. So I changed my road. I went there alone in my car to see what was going on. And you couldn't get in into the village. There was a blockage and police and... So then I turned around, I went back to the board, and I said, I'm changing my production, I've got to go back there. That's how it started. And there was nobody to do sound. There was one guy, and he says, oh, me, I hate guns. I'll go, but the minute I see a gun, I leave. Well, I said, don't bother coming. Just stay here. So I did the sound. And we thought it would last maybe 3-4 days. And it went on for 78 days.
A peace camp is established in Oka. On this first weekend, more than 2,500 people come from across the continent to show their support for the Mohawk Nation.
Why is it that we live in a country where the police never come to the aid of the Aboriginal people? And yet we see them across this country being utilized by provincial governments to suppress the rights of the Aboriginal people of this country.
It's a very small village in Kanesatake, and they lost a lot of land. It was really stolen from them through the church. And now they have a golf course there in an area that's very sacred to them. And their cemetery is right there. And now the town of Oka, the mayor and their population wanted to enlarge the golf course, 9 more holes. And the Mohawks were against it and made a stand. They didn't want them to. They were going to do the golf course and build condominiums around that area. And finally, the mayor threatened them that he was going to call the police and to make sure that they would remove them, the ones who were standing to say, you're not coming in here. The atmosphere was horrifying. You never knew what was going to happen from one minute to the next. The army, at the end, the soldiers and the warriors were constantly insulting each other. So it was very scary, because if one person, either a warrior or a soldier, would have shot one thing, that was the end. There would have been a real massacre in there. So that's what everybody was afraid of.
In the journalist's bunker in Oka, they watch as the SQ protected by the army raids the Kakwita Island in Kahnawake.
There was a shootout one day in July, the 11th, I think, in 1990. when the SWAT team ordered them to leave and they said no, they weren't leaving, they start throwing tear gas at them. And there was a major in the police force that got killed. But I was afraid many times. If I had said I wasn't, I'd be lying.
Mm-hmm.
It's pitch dark at night, and you're constantly listening. If there's a sound somewhere, you run there. I'll tell you a funny story.
Please do.
One morning, I arrived with the crew, and we were down the hill. And by then we had received accreditation. And the police told us, you can only stay on this road. You're not allowed to go on the side street. But we never obeyed that. We went all over. And we went across the golf course, and then we would go behind the barricade. And then around 9:30, all the reporters would come down. So one morning, I'm there with the crew, and there was nothing was happening. It was very quiet. There was just one police officer at the bottom of the hill. So I start making a conversation with him, and he said, I'm going to warn you. I know that every day you go behind, and you know you're not allowed. And he says, and so if you do that with your crew today, when you come down tonight, we're going to take your accreditation away. Then you won't even be allowed to come back in here. I said, well, you wouldn't even know what's going on there if the reporters didn't go in the back, you know. I said, to hell with this. I didn't come here to be with a crew to be with this police officer and just watch him, you know. I said, we're going. And you know, we were shooting 16 mil. They look at us like dinosaurs because everybody was doing video.
Mm-hmm.
So we went through and we spent the day there. And at night, at 9:30, we're all coming down. And the police had a barricade made of sandbags. And you had to go through a very narrow space when you came down from the hill. And I thought, oh my God, what's going to happen? So we come through this little passage you had to go through. And they had a light right on your face. You can't see who's talking to you.
Mm-hmm.
And all the light is on you. So we go through, and the police say, what's your name? I say, I'm Alanis Obamsawin. Who do you work for? I say, the National Film Board of Canada. And I hear another voice, another police officer. He says, Alanis Obamsawin? I said, yes. Oh, I love everything you do. He said, what are you going to do? Are you going to sing us Oka, or are you going to make a film? And he was so gentle, and it was so funny. I said, I was so shocked because I expected to have so much trouble.
Right.
And so I went right through, like butter in the frying pan. I tell you, it was all kinds of stuff like that. Every now and then that would happen.
Huh.
Sometimes I was put down badly, and other times I was praised.
Right.
Yeah.
So you've made 50 films with the National Film Board. And your films have never really seemed to be careful about criticizing the nation and the state and the role of government in continuing colonial conflicts with Indigenous people in this country. And I'm wondering whether you've ever faced friction with your producers because of that.
First of all, I produce my own films. For those reasons. Because when I first began to work, it was very, very hard, very difficult. And there were many problems that I had that I was so used to, these kinds of problems because of racism, because of who I am and all those things, that I never realized that it was also difficult to be a woman in that world. And so the prejudice and the feeling that people who never met you know more about you than they think you know about yourself. They tell you who you are, you know? And that's a big mistake with me because I fight back.
Mm-hmm. Was there a particular turning point where you felt like things had changed for you working within the NFP?
Oh, yes.
What was that turning point?
Well, before it came, I had a lot of hard times. Yeah. Like when I was working on this film, Incident at Restigouche, that was in 1981. I had a lot of trouble to make this film. You know, one person told me I wasn't allowed to interview any whites. I could only interview Indians.
What was the reason for that?
Because she was a racist, because this was, and she had a very high, powerful job there, and she looked at me as if I was less than all of them. You know, it was hard to fight, but I fought it and had a hard time, but that's why that film came out in 1984. We all shot it in 1981.
Hmm. Who was it that you interviewed that you weren't supposed to interview?
Oh, the one that really made that woman furious, because I interviewed the Minister of Fisheries.
I'm surprised that a Minister of Fisheries would even appear. How did you convince him to do that?
I did.
So they didn't...
The hard way, standing up in a canoe.
The government of Quebec will recognize a collectivity at Moriah, which is entirely sovereign. How far does that sovereignty go? It's a question of definition. Does it go as far as, for example, control of the whole resource? Certain native chiefs are creating illusions for the native people. The Gaspé Peninsula, New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, etc. It belongs to us. Do you mean to tell me at this point, Montreal too belongs to you?
Of course, all Canada belongs to us.
Are you saying that you're going to exclude us?
Did we tell you to get the hell out of here? We never said that. We always shared. You took. Instead of being proud of us, you talk of your history, your Quebec. The history of Quebec does not begin with the French Canadians.
At first, I really disliked him. And by the time I was finished, I start to understand him as a... I kind of admire the fact, like, although they told him, don't go, I really come to Montreal to interview him. And he says, everybody told me, don't go there. She's going to make mincemeat out of you.
And did you?
Well, I don't eat meat. I'm a vegetarian. One person, when he figured out, looked at what I had done, he said, Alanis, I want you to finish this film. It's an important film. And my life changed there. But it took... a lot of pain and a lot of awful stories. The mandate of the board is to tell Canada to Canadians and the world. And if over the time, from the beginning the board was created, there were things that you felt was wrong, or I was smart enough to know that this was not the film board doing this to me, it was an individual for other reasons. Mm. And this is what you have to recognize, because these institutions for the country are incredible. And so you have to be able to understand it, not be afraid, and when you find that there's something wrong, you have to say it.
In speaking to someone like you who has seen so many changes through the last, I don't know, 50 years, several decades, do you feel... optimistic? Like, are there things that are heartening for you in viewing the future for Indigenous people in this place?
What I feel right now, I've not developed the way to express it yet as well as I feel it. For me, it's much higher than hope, because I see a lot of changes all across the country, mainly in education. And I think since the reconciliation movement, the Canadians are starting to be educated in terms of what the truth is in this country. And because children go to school and they're getting trained there and they're getting an education, it's very important. But imagine how dangerous it is also, in terms of how the Canadians were educated in terms of our people at the classroom level. If I'm here today, it's because of the way I was treated then, because I revolted and I just knew I would never accept that and say it's all right. It wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
And this last film I made is like, it's such a gift for me to have seen and be witness of an incredible school in Norway House.
And it's in Manitoba, right?
Yes, mm-hmm. Northern Manitoba.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that film because I just saw it last night.
Oh, really?
Yeah. At first, when I was watching it, it almost seemed like I was like, oh, this film is going to be without an internal conflict. Like, you've made films that were like right embedded in the middle of a conflict while it was happening. And in this film, you were showing the school that was incredibly resourced, not only for a school on a reserve, but for a school
anywhere.
Yeah, anywhere. It was an amazing thing. And yet there are these moments in the film where these kids talk about, in some way, being worried about what will happen when they leave that space.
Mm-hmm.
And there is this implication in, for me, like this kind of bittersweet aspect to it, which is that even in creating an incredible, supportive school environment for young kids, there is this sense that eventually they'll have to leave. They'll have to go to Winnipeg, this place where people they know have gone missing and been murdered. And I just wonder, there is this conflict happening in the country right now around young kids, young Indigenous kids leaving the reserve. And I guess I just wonder what you imagine the best possible future is for these kids. Do you think it is to stay in their community, or is it to leave? And
it's, you cannot say that mm-hmm. one or the other. Each individual feels differently. And this community is very big. There's 8,000 people living there. It's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And some go and come back, and some stay away. It's the same in every community. But the possibility there for people to have a wonderful life there is possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really saw that in the film. There were scenes where mm-hmm. you show a 9-day canoe trip, and when the kids are looking at things, we feel as viewers what it is to be connected to that place.
And you know, all those problems that are there also are, there's a lot of will to heal themselves. This is why it's called that, you know, when Gordon says, our people will be healed.
Mm-hmm.
It's incredible. And he recognizes, like many young people do now, that it's not alcohol and it's not drugs that's going to help you to feel good about yourself. And it's not suicide either. And there's a lot of strong movement in a lot of places to change that. And I'm not saying that it's all cured. That's not true. But it's very different.
Why did you think that it was important to create this film that isn't necessarily about a conflict, a particular kind of conflict, but to show a different side of a community?
I don't make films to show conflict. I do it because I have to document what's going on. There's no conflict here. It's fantastic. You know, they, of course, they've had the missing woman, and that's horrifying. We also have to know that. But the survival and the way of teaching and knowing that for the young people that something in their own of their own tradition is there to help themselves, it's to go back to certain ways of being and thinking, and the love of the land and of nature, and know that that's where the healing is.
I was
was just wondering, did you go on the full 9-day trip when you were filming?
Yeah, I followed and I got a very bad cold because we were sleeping in tents outside.
Yeah.
And when I'm interviewing the children, I sound like a bear. My voice is just, I'm also embarrassed every time I hear myself. But my God, I had a hard time to talk. It's such a sore throat.
I was just thinking that when I was listening to it, where I was like, trying to figure out whether you were on the whole thing or you had stopped at some point, and then I heard your voice and I was like, oh no, she's doing the whole trip.
You're damn right. Every film I make, I'm there all the way.
That was Alanis Obomsawin, who is definitely the most badass 85-year-old I've ever met. You heard her song, My Spirit, It Weakens, from her 1984 album, Indian Songs, and you also heard clips from her films, Incident at Restigouche and Kanasatake, 270 Years of Resistance. You can watch both of them for free, along with a lot of Alanis's other films, on the National Film Board's website. Find links at canadalandshow.com/imp. I produced this episode of The Imposter with assistance from Ali Graham and Kevin Sexton. Our theme music is by Nathan Burley. You can follow me on Twitter at Aliyah Pabani, and you can follow the show on Twitter at Imster, that's I-M-P-S-T-R, where we seem to be picking up followers from a spicy South African teledrama that's also called The Imposter. If you have 30 seconds, do us a favor and give us a rating on iTunes because it helps people find the show. Our crowdfunding site is patreon.com/CanadaLand, and if you like The Imposter, tell your people about it.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.